This week, one of the Talmidim in the center program, asked me a very interesting question. He said, he notices boys come into the yeshiva, and some come in with no background at all. Some come in with very little acquaintance with Torah. And after not too long a period of time, they start changing their lifestyle, their dress, their habits, their behavior, their language. And he said, if you talk to them, you don't find that they have a profound grasp of the principles and the reasons and the explanations. And he guesses that they are impressed with their teachers, impressed perhaps with their personalities or with their general intelligence or focus, application, have relationships with their teachers which are supportive of them. And then they imitate their teacher's behavior, often on a very superficial level, like their clothes, haircut, hairstyle. And he says, this is very superficial. It doesn't represent a real understanding. It's just being affected by the environment and personalities that they find personally inspiring. And isn't that terrible? So I said to him, yes, basically it's terrible. Really, we don't preach that. We really would rather have people make much more gradual transitions and really understand better what they're doing, have a better basis. Indeed, that's one of the reasons the center program was created, to get them away from the base medrash, where those young, hot-headed fanatics will ruin the person's chances of turning out normal. I will put undue influence on their development. But then I said to him, I don't think that this is unique to yeshiva. I think this is true everywhere. People's most fundamental beliefs, values, philosophy, very rarely based on any understanding at all. They're based on the fact that either that's what everyone is doing, or some of their the people whose character they respect, or what they perceive of their character they respect, because they don't see the rest of it. It's a matter of personal relationships or inspiration, and very little a matter of understanding. When I was a college student, like all of my friends, we were all liberals, except for those who were radicals. All on the left. Why? Because our professors were basically on the left. It was almost non-existent for someone to ask why. I discovered that when I met someone who asked me why, and I was desperately without answers. So then I started to think, you know, it was pretty embarrassing studying philosophy. Somebody asked me why I take my political position, I didn't have any ideas. And then I started to ask around, and I found that most people didn't know why. It was just the chic thing to do. You wouldn't be caught dead with a conservative idea in your head. I mean, you know, just couldn't live that way. Now, what I want to do for you this evening is to run through some reflections on democracy. Today, democracy is it. Capital I, capital T. There's nothing you can say against democracy. Wherever you go, that is the, at least in ideology, in values, that's the top of the heap. Almost no one understands what democracy is good for, what it means, why it's supposed to be so important, and what its limitations are. And it can be useful to take an audience of sorts, the Talmidim, through this, to expose their own weakness in their understanding what they believe in, also to show that you understand it better than they do, and to open them up to the idea that maybe the values that they worship, because they're popular, have weaknesses that they aren't aware of. So let's start. The proposition that's most important about democracy is that it's the only legitimate form of government. It's the only legitimate form of government. Every other form of government is morally wrong. Any other form of government is a kind of tyranny. And tyranny is immoral, unjust. Only democracy is a legitimate form of government. My question is, why would that be? Why would anybody think that? Well, what is there in democracy that makes it legitimate, valid, appropriate, morally justified? And any alternative that's not democratic has to be regarded as immoral.
Well, I think for a king who's for the people and then given over to the people the way it's supposed to be, why is that immoral?
Number one, it's a fairy tale. Even the democratic governments aren't good for them. But leave that aside. They will tell you that the king's authority is illegitimate, only he happens to be using it to benefit people. That doesn't make it legitimate. Although, in the deeper point, here lies part of the tale of the story that I want to tell you. But what's that? I mean, what is the thought that only democracy is a legitimate form of government? Everything else is illegitimate. It's inherently unjust, wrong. Well, I'm not going to rest with this idea. I'm talking about
having. Because it's not really self-government. It's
not
collective. It's
a representative
of what most people want.
So what?
He had
his hand up. Rubo Kekulam. I doubt that that's, you know, Acharav Lahatos is the basis of the average Americans. But even so what are Rubo Kekulam? Where's the moral purchase here? Why is it morally right and everything else is morally wrong? It's not Rubo Kekulam. So what? Yeah.
Nobody else but you should have power over them. At least more than they have influence over anyone else.
I think this is it. So it is. No one has the right to tell anybody else what to do. To force somebody else to act one way or another. That's what's wrong. What's morally wrong is one person forcing another person to act against his will. That's wrong. Okay, so now, let's move to the end now. So one person telling another person to act against his will is wrong. But all government does that. Every government does that. That's what you have a police force for. Push people around against their will. So, even democracy isn't going to avoid. It isn't going to avoid forcing people to act against their will. Right? Nothing can avoid that. Only anarchy can do that. And even in anarchy, then the criminals will take over. So, we need to push it to the end now. Somebody should turn that.
I asked him to tell me.
No, you voted against it. You disagree, and you're against it all the way through. And the police say we have to do it anyway, because the majority said so. So what? If it's wrong to force people to do something they don't want to do, so then why is it wrong when the majority does it? Oh, who's that? You said? It's the lesser of two evils. Forcing anybody to do something against his will is wrong. How much wrong are you going to have? In a democracy, you'll have the least amount of wrong. Because the majority will get to do what they want, and only the minority will be told to do what they don't want. Any other form of government leaves it open that the majority will have to act against their will. That's a bigger wrong. It's an economy of wrong. How much wrong are you going to tolerate? As little as possible. Set up a society in which there's as little wrong as possible. So if the majority gets to decide what's going to happen, then only a minority will be forced to act against their will. It's not nice to force even the minority to do it, but for society to function, you've got to have cooperation and unity of action. So you do it on the basis of majority.
Majorities tend necessarily to get conformed.
I'm coming to that. I'm coming to that. That has nothing to do with legitimacy. Here the thought is, no one has the right to tell me what to do. Even if he's better informed than I. Even if he's better informed than I. That doesn't give him the right to force me to act. It might give him the obligation to try to educate me, but it doesn't give him the right to force me to act. So, the idea is that this is the only legitimate form of government, because any other form of government is going to have too much wrong. Extra wrong. Wrong that could be avoided. The wrong of forcing too many people to act against their will. You with me? This, I think, is the fundamental idea. Now let's talk about limitations. So, 86% of the people vote in a direct vote to murder 14%. I have to make this up, huh? This has happened. 86% vote to murder the 14%. And they carry it out. Is that morally valid? Morally justified? After all, it was instituted by the only legitimate form of government, democracy. What will the believer in democracy say?
The core
Let's understand. We're talking about democracy now. We're not talking about the United States of America. No, we're talking about the idea of democracy.
Every democracy has a basic constitutional
right to use citizens. Okay. Let me try to avoid this problem. The word democracy has nothing to do with basic rights. The word democracy has nothing to do with charity. The word democracy has to do with who holds the power in the society. Someone said the idea was self-government. That's right. Autocracy means one person has all the power. Democracy means the power is with the people as a whole. The power. Yes, typically, democratic governments and democratic societies have other moral commitments as well, like rights to protect minorities and things like that. But that has nothing to do with democracy.
In Greece, it didn't.
In Greece, it didn't. Greece was democratic, and they had slaves, and democracy just tells you who holds the power. How is the power administered? And it's administered through the people as a whole. So what are we going to say about a democracy where 86% vote to murder 14%? Shall we say that because the government is legitimate, as the only legitimate government, therefore, the decision and the action of murdering the 14% is appropriate? No one's going to agree to that. Hopefully. If you get something like that, then this year, give up. You can't do it. So what you have to say is, even if the government is legitimate, that doesn't mean that all its decisions are morally appropriate. It means having a legitimate government is a value. It's a value. It's one value. But it's not the only value we have. There are other values. And sometimes the other values are so strong that they override the decisions of a legitimate government. Here's where minority rights come marching. Minority rights say, let's understand. Let's understand. You have a rule of minority rights. Let's say, no murder of this kind. So what are you doing? You are forcing 86% to act against their will. That was the whole point of democracy. Not to push people around. Not to force them to act against their will. That was the point of it. So here you say, even if 86% wanted it, it's wrong. And if I have the power all by myself to stop the 86%, I should do it. And I'm forcing 86% to go against their will. Too bad, because the will of the 86% here is evil. So, the evil of pushing people around is not the only evil. There are lots of evils. Democracy is the only legitimate form of government because it minimizes this particular evil, the evil of pushing people around. But when the evil of pushing people around competes with mass murder, mass murder is a worse evil. And then indeed, it's morally right to yes, push people around. when Greenpeace lobbies the government to pass a conservation rule which is against the will of the majority of the citizens, what are they doing? They're asking the government to exercise its power to compel the majority of citizens to do something they don't want to do. They don't embarrass, they're not embarrassed about that. They're not repentant about that. Aye, it violates the whole rationale of democracy. True, but destroying the environment is worse than violating democracy. They don't mind.
Who decides that?
I think there's no general answer to that question. I'm just pointing, in other words, each person or each group will have to decide what its order of values is. I'm just pointing out to you, and you can point out to the people you're talking to, that even as important as democracy is, there are other things that are more important than democracy. That's one limitation that I think people will buy quite readily. Now let's move on to something a little more subtle. Greece, where this idea came from, practiced what's called a direct democracy. Direct democracy means all the citizens vote on every issue. They all get together and they vote.
There's a definition of citizenship is limited.
Okay, but the idea of direct democracy is all the citizens vote. By the way, citizenship for voting is always limited. Six-year-olds can't vote. But I'm not doing that now. I did that with you once before. So, that's direct democracy. We have what's called representative democracy. We don't vote on every issue. We elect representatives, and they vote on the issues. Yeah, okay, sometimes you have what's called a plebiscite, where the whole population votes, but it's once in a million years. And you control, the population controls through periodic votes for its representatives, but you only vote for representatives. Now, let's ask, is that just a matter of practicality? How are you going to vote on every issue? I mean, let's be serious. Think 100 years ago. What are you going to do? Go around and vote on every issue? There are hundreds of issues a year. But today, well, you could do it through a computer, through a pattern recognition program, put your thumbprint on a screen, you know, on an active screen like a palm, and registers in the CIA in Washington, and then everybody votes. Come home every night, turn on the computer, here are the 16 issues you have to vote on today. Raising the budget, lowering the budget, war, peace, you know, whatever it is. Bump rail on, yes, no, different paths, you know. Suppose we could work it out practically to vote on every issue. It's not the only reason why we have a representative government, because it's too difficult, it's too impractical to vote on every issue. He's suggesting that maybe we would want representative government even if we could practically vote on every issue. Now, why would we do that?
We're not informed enough. It's a full-day job to vote on every issue.
We're not informed enough. So, if we all vote, the decisions are going to be?
Bad decisions.
Bad decisions.
Not even what we want.
Yeah, yeah, bad. Okay, let's go step by step. It's going to be bad decisions. Bad in what respect?
The whole democracy was there to bring out the good for every single person. This will have a counter effect.
Gee, you've now mentioned something we haven't said till now. Bring out the good for every person. Did we say that as the idea of democracy? We said the idea of democracy was don't push me around. Don't force me to do something against my will. We didn't say anything about good. You've invented a new rationale now. But I still want to understand. He says the decisions will be bad decisions. Bad in what respect? What will make them bad?
It won't be what we really want.
Huh?
Not what we really want.
Why? What about it will be what we really want? They'll be dumb. They won't work. You know?
Lowest common denominator.
Lowest common denominator. That's what Aristotle said. You know, he said democracy is the government of the worst. Because the vast majority of people that cut in the population are the worst, least educated, the least experienced, the least creative. Right? Sure. But leave that aside for a moment. Listen to what we're saying now. Listen to what we're saying, boys and girls. We're saying that we won't use direct democracy because decisions will be inefficient. They'll be inefficient They won't produce the best possible results. We'll make economic decisions, we'll make military decisions, the wars will fail instead of succeed, economics will go down. Drive on the left side of the road on Sunday so driving won't be boring. But there'll be lower accidents. No. So, look at what we're doing now. When you have a representative democracy, you have the possibility, and I would say more than the possibility, you have the probability that the government will make decisions that go against what the majority of the people want. So by having a representative democracy, you are sacrificing. You're sacrificing part of the rationale for democracy. You're allowing the situation in which the majority are going to be pushed around. You're allowing it. Why are you allowing it? For efficiency. Look what you're trading for what? You told me that the democratic form of government is the only morally legitimate, form of government. Anything else is tyranny. Now, representative democracy is a partial tyranny. It's a partial tyranny because there'll be situations in which the government will do things which are against the will of the majority. They say, that's all right, we'll make more money that way. So what are you doing, on the surface anyway, you're trading morality for money. You're trading the preservation of individual freedom, you're trading that for more efficient decisions. So how deeply committed are you to democracy, if you're willing to do this? Yes?
I'm going to kind of argue that the reason how the representatives got there is that people knew their position. They knew where the elected officials stand on the economy and all sorts of issues. And they sent them there to represent them, to bring those ideas to legislation.
You could argue that if you didn't live in a democratic state. But if you lived in a democratic state, maybe you had a few white hairs, and you've been to a few elections, you would know very well that what is promised during the campaign and what actually happens during the term of office have very little relationship to one another. And everybody in democracy knows that.
That's a flaw in the system.
But you are saying now why it is that we're prepared to put up with this, because we know their positions. But we know very well that their positions will change once they get into office.
Every system is flawed.
Correct. But you can't say that.
The ideals of democracy.
No. I'm talking now about in practice. We're talking now about America. I have a program that I patented. With this program, everybody can vote directly. Are you in favor of changing over the system for a direct vote? He says no. You know why? Because you're going to get lousy decisions. You're going to get poor decisions. Right? The reason why is not because I know what the guy's going to do. I'm talking about America now. People who vote in America now know very well that what's promised in the campaign often has nothing to do with what goes on there. So that's not the point. The point is, as he said, people know I'm too ignorant to give an intelligent vote on the vast majority of issues that are going to come up. So my vote, it would be like voting for procedures in a hospital. Should we democratize the hospitals? It's the city hospital. Let the city vote on the hospital procedures. After all, it's funded by city money, isn't it? Shouldn't the people who get the money have control over what happens? No one will vote. No one will be in favor of that. Because we're not doctors. Well, we're not economists, and we're not agronomists, and we're not military people. And so, therefore, we're not in a position to do it. So we're allowing the government the power to do things against our will so as to get more efficient decisions. We are trading this very appealing, very popular justification of democracy. Don't push me around. Don't tell me what to do. We're trading it for money. That, on the bottom line, that's what we're doing. We're trading it for more efficient decisions.
We chose it.
We're choosing a system in which there is... Well, this leads to, in a sense, the paradox of democracy. Right? What will democratic theory say about a country that democratically elects a dictator? Well, they didn't elect him a dictator. They elected him as whatever they called it, head of state. And he took it. He did a chancellor. And he took it over after. But what will happen if a country democratically decides to give up democracy? I don't think that those who believe in democracy will allow that as an appropriate thing to do morally. But let me press the point. Let me press the point by illustrating the difference between the United States and other democracies. I don't know if anybody else is like the United States in this respect. The United States is a republic. Others have what are called a parliamentary democracy. What's the difference? What's the key element in a parliament? It can be dissolved at any time. You can have new elections at any time. In America, you can't do that. The elections are fixed absolutely by law. So, in England, or in France, or in Israel, the public has a kind of indirect leverage against the government. If sentiment changes radically, and enough are going to gain by it, they'll bring down the government so as to gain from the public sentiment in a new election.
That can't happen in the U.S.
That cannot happen in the U.S. The senators are every 6 years, representatives are every 2 years, presidents every 4 years.
Can't bring them
down. No, that's something else. You don't bring down the government, you kick him out and put a replacement in. You can't bring the American Constitution doesn't allow that. So, you have them in. Once he's in, and he has the powers of office until the next election, and he can do something that nobody likes, not even his wife. Everybody's against it, doesn't it? According to law, it's binding. The president can pardon criminals. He alone can pardon a criminal. Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. Because he didn't want the country plunged into that kind of bushes that they'll take him apart. Greasy Nixon. You don't remember that era. That was really something. Anyway, now look. One of the justifications for having a system like the United States is this. Let's suppose that there's something the country needs. And it's a long-term project. And for the first couple of years, it's going to cause a lot of grief. And only after 3 years is it going to start to show profit. And by 4 years, the profit is going to be fabulous. Now, somebody's elected president. What should he do? He's got 4 years. He's got 4 years for sure. So he can afford it. He can afford to undertake the project, which for 2 years is going to cause terrible grief. Because he knows 4 years from now it's going to be a fabulous success. And then he'll be able to be re-elected on it. Whereas, in Britain or in France or in Israel, it could very well happen that after 18 months of grief, the people will be out of patience, and they'll bring down the government and re-elect, and he won't be able to finish it. Which means he won't start it. He won't start it. So the thought is that with a system like the United States, you can do things that will hurt. And the vast majority of people will be bitterly opposed. In the hopes that in the end, they'll be able to get some profit out of it. I mean, the profit may not come. But it gives you that possibility of enforcing your will against the vast majority. Because you can get a bigger payoff. Which is now an even more profound violation of the idea of democracy. You're forcing more people to act against their will, against their judgment, against their freedom, because you can make a very nice profit. A very large profit. Poor Tony Blair. If he didn't have the conservatives on his side to support him against his own rebellious liberals, he could have been in serious trouble in the Commons. And being in trouble with Commons could be a serious problem. But in America, Bush didn't run that risk because he's got another year and a half. And as it was, the war turned out extremely well. And he's a hero. Somebody else might not have been able to get through it. So here's another illustration of how we're sacrificing democracy for the sake of efficiency. Now, that then ought to give the believer in democracy some pause. How important is this really? How important is it really? You with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, a related idea comes from a slightly different angle. When I was teaching at Hopkins, students who were applying to law school needed special recommendations. Hopkins doesn't have a law school, so they couldn't go to a law professor to get a recommendation. So they sent them around to people in related fields. Philosophy. related to everything. And so from time to time, I had to, interview these students. And I used to ask them two questions. And by the basis of their response, I would write a recommendation. One question was, someone comes to you for you to function as their attorney, and you happen to know he's guilty. Can you, in good conscience, function as his attorney and work as hard as possible to get him acquitted, judged innocent, if you know he's guilty? That was one question. And then the other question, which is relevant to us, was this. It is said in American social thinking, that's not an oxymoron, better 99 criminals go free than one innocent person go to jail. Better 99 criminals go free than one innocent person go to jail. The Manafkamina. Manafkamina is for standards of proof to convict in court. How hard do you make it to convict somebody? How much evidence do you need? How much proof do you need? If you are desperately afraid of putting innocent people in jail, you make it very hard to convict. If you make it very hard to convict, a lot of guilty people are going to go free because you don't have enough evidence to convict them. So if you really say, better 99 criminals go free than one innocent person go to jail, you make the standards of proof very high. And then indeed, very seldom will innocent people go to jail, but a lot of criminals are going to go free. The alternative is to lower the standards of proof, put lots more people in jail, get a lot of criminals in jail, but inevitably you'll get some mistakes, you'll get some innocent people in jail as well. That's the American thought. The American thought is, make very high standards of proof so innocent people don't go to jail. Now the question is, why? Why is that an appropriate position? After all, those 99 criminals who go free, what are they going to do? They're going to victimize people. Steal, murder, assault, battery, fraud. Right? It's not going to be pleasant. Now, what are you afraid of? An innocent person will go to jail? At least in jail they'll feed him, you know. They're not going to murder him. Why is it better? Is it that there'll be less suffering? Let's take the numbers seriously for a second. 99 criminals free versus one person going to jail. Which way has more suffering for the public at large? The one person in jail or the 99 criminals who are left free to work their crime? Seems to me like the 99 criminals are going to cause far more suffering than the one guy going to jail. So what would be the justification for such a position? Why would someone opt for such a position? You are creating social misery. The mafia is not gentle. Along with the rest of them, from Jamaica and from Ireland and from all over. I don't want to talk about the Jewish life. Sure. And in other countries, they carried out murders. In Russia, it was famous. Jewish life. Anyway. Well, so what is the... Is there a justification for it, for this attitude? What would the justification be? The question that I asked them is, what could be said in favor of better 99 criminals go free than one innocent person go to jail? What could be said in favor of that idea? You didn't get the answer to this. You probably didn't get it also.
Loyal to democracy.
Sorry?
It's loyal to democracy. I'm not imposing your... Where the will to lock people up to prevent crime from
innocent. Okay, now look. What you're expressing is a kind of clean hands attitude. My hands are clean. I didn't hurt anybody. Yeah, but you instituted a rule whereby lots of people got hurt. Let's think now of the society as a whole. We don't want people to get hurt. We don't want people to be pushed around. Those 99 criminals are going to push people around. So in terms of the good or evil for the society as a whole, the democratic idea, people shouldn't be pushed around, 99 criminals are going to violate that. So why wouldn't we lock them up?
If one guy goes to jail because he's not fed, he goes for no reason to jail.
My goodness gracious. Even in our system, from time to time, there are mistakes made. Does that mean the whole society is disintegrating?
No.
Because one person, innocent person goes to jail.
And you won't have them, you won't have them, but you know that.
I don't know what that means. Society will say, we are protecting so many of you by putting the 99 criminals in jail. It's worth it to make a mistake from time to time.
Nothing mistake.
It's a mistake. Like, again, how is this going to happen? It's going to happen by lowering the standards of proof. So you have evidence, and you have witnesses, and you have what the policeman said, and what they saw, and the photographs, and you make it easier to put the person in jail. Sometimes the evidence is going to be a mistake.
If you lower the standards,
yes.
you run the risk of making the police have too much power.
This, I think, is the real thought here. The thought is you're giving too much power to the government. You're giving too much power to the government.
It's not just.
No, that's not the thought. Because after all, it's not just that the criminals should be able to victimize the public either. That's not just.
That's the problem with the government, not with the justice.
So then we're back to the clean hand attitude. You know, my hands are clean. I, they're being murdered, but I didn't do it.
No, the government has come with another system, but as far as justice, the judicial system,
we can't. Don't call it justice. Call it a judicial system is just applying the laws as they're passed. And the laws say you need very little evidence to convict people because we want to keep, you know, we had a fellow visit the Soviet Union. And he was told that in Moscow you could take your wallet and put it on a park bench full of dollar bills, come back 3 days later and it would still be sitting there. No one would touch it. Because the KGB would send it to Siberia today. Turn you around, turn you back for 30 seconds, it's gone. Right? So it is possible to protect people if you have a very strong police system and courts with very low standards of proof so that you can put criminals in jail.
But that's not justice.
Don't call it justice. The question is, what's the best social policy? Especially if you're concerned with democracy, if you're concerned with preserving freedom, if you're concerned with people not being pushed around, then you have to be concerned with the fact that criminals will push people around. What do we have a police force for? To stop criminals from pushing people around. So now you say, oh yeah, but as long as the government doesn't do it, it's okay if the criminals do it. Watch it own. If you could save more, I mean, if it's really 99 to 1, and that's the way it's said in America, better 99 criminals go free than one person go to jail. If I put all 100 in jail, aren't less people pushed around? And if less people are pushed around, and the whole theory is that not people shouldn't be pushed, people shouldn't be pushed around, then put them all in jail, put the whole 100 in jail. The society as a whole will have more freedom. Yeah.
What about the issue of the fact that the innocent guy who's thrown in jail is being violated and mistreated while it's only something that they're going to do something wrong?
You're not living in the real world. You're not suffering. You know how many billions and billions of dollars a crime means in this world? You know? We had a fellow here at the yeshiva a number of years ago who came from Russia. He, in a year or so, made a couple of million dollars selling precious materials from the Soviet Union illegally on the black market, and he said that of course you had to authenticate the materials that you were selling were real. So he said, we hired a few bums, I hope you met professors of physics, who work for $200 an hour. You know, those are guys that, you know, they're just lackeys, you know, to perform some tests to authenticate that the materials are real. You know, they're just buying shelves. It meant nothing to them. Right? This is what you're talking about. You're talking about a well-financed, well-organized criminal ring, which makes billions and billions of dollars. And somebody gets in the way, they kill them, and it doesn't bother them. Now, if you could knock out 100 of those and put one person in jail, the economy of saving human misery would certainly be positive. You'd certainly be positive. But the thought is, you're giving too much power to the government. And if the government has too much power and it starts to victimize people, then crime looks like small peanuts. When the government victimizes people, then crime is small peanuts. Because the government has enormous power. Even more power than crime. Sorry?
You think they're doing the good of society?
No, again.
Nothing. They're raising the standards of, lowering the standards of evidence to send the guy to jail.
And then
they're doing it for the good of the society.
But you can't guarantee that they'll do it for the good of the society.
Right.
Maybe they'll put their political enemies in jail with the power that they have. Maybe not in the white, in like the southern United States, the whites will put blacks in jail and won't prosecute whites for the same crime. How do you know they're going to use the power? America's government was born in a revolution against tyranny. A lot of American governmental system is based on weakening the government. Why are there three branches? Checks and balances. So that there shouldn't be too much power in one pocket. You know, now that has become a hallmark of democracy. People talk about it as fundamental. This country, which is totally confused and totally corrupt, the High Court and the rest of it, and they talk as if, you know, as if they don't understand the language. Separation of powers is fundamental democracy. It has nothing to do with it. Separation of powers means you're making sure that there isn't too much power in one pocket. And it's very dangerous because it's never completely clear how the different powers are related. When Nixon said, "I'm not obeying the Supreme Court to turn over the tapes of my conversation, my telephone conversations," there could have been a total breakdown of government. Because he said, "I have a responsibility to protect the power of the executive branch, and I don't have to give in to the judicial branch. We're equal and separate branches, the government. They can't tell me what to do." Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, Jeb, said in the last election, "If the Supreme Court will require us to count the ballots differently in Florida, I'm not going to obey them. They don't have jurisdiction in this case." Because in America, the election of the president is done through the Electoral College. Each state elects its representatives to go to the Electoral College and cast their vote. And therefore, it is fundamentally a state right to determine how it will elect its representatives, and the Supreme Court has no business telling them what to do. So he said, if they tell us, I'm not going to do it. That's like secession. The state will say, I don't accept the authority of the federal government on this issue. It's really not clear in all cases how they're related. That's great, because it means it's going to be quite difficult for the government to act in a concerted fashion, and therefore it will only be done when there's a very wide consensus of what should be done, and that way the general population is going to be protected. Trial by jury. Who's in the jury? Jury of your peers. Gosh, thanks a lot. You know, do I really want my peers? And by the way, most professionals who have any expertise to really do it right are disqualified at the outset because they're not regarded as psychologists, can't do it, and my father, Oliver Sholem, was in insurance. They never let him be on a jury. Lawyers can't be on a jury. The people who know the system and know the facts, they're not allowed to be. It's got to be Tom, Dick, and Harry off the street. Right?
They don't know anything.
Yeah, they don't know anything. You know, they're certainly not qualified. You can play in their emotions and all the rest of it. Yeah, give me a break. But it means the government cannot put anybody in jail. The government can't put anyone in jail. Only other citizens can put somebody in jail. All of this has one rationale: to weaken the power of the government. Now, this is the balance on the other side to what we said before about giving the government more power. What you want in democracy, I think the bottom line concern of democracy is to prevent against tyranny. That's really the bottom line. If that guy in the Oval Office knows that in 4 years he needs my vote, he's going to be careful. He's not going to be too high-handed. As long as the system stays, he's not going to absorb me. It's a check. I won't say he won't. Nixon did. But it'll be difficult. It'll be difficult. As long as the commitment to democracy is strong, it's very unlikely that there's going to be tyranny. Now, how much democracy do you need to protect against tyranny? Then you can tolerate representatives, and you can tolerate a republic rather than a parliamentary system where you have elections only a certain amount of years. Yes, from time to time, there'll be decisions against the will of the vast majority. Quite right, because doing it in that way, from time to time, with the check of always being able to vote them out of office, is enough to protect against tyranny. So where do we start from? that the only legitimate form of government is democracy because no one shall push around anybody else. We now realize that legitimate governments can make morally wrong decisions and have to be overruled. And we give up direct democracy because of efficiency. And we give up parliamentary democracy because of more sophisticated efficiency, a long-term project that's going to be very unpopular for a short time. And only later it'll be popular. People come to realize it later, but in the meantime, you're forcing them to do something totally against their will. And that perhaps the secondary goal of democracy, or maybe I should put it, the most dramatic goal, I should put that way, the most dramatic or fundamental goal of democracy is to prevent against tyranny. And for that, you don't need so much democracy. You just need enough to make sure that the guy's afraid to go to push his power too far. And that's why we check the power of the government in the ways that we do. This is a completely different picture of how democracy works and why it works from what people typically think. I think it's much closer to the truth. Are you with me? Okay, I have two more political observations to make that you can use. I think these are important for us directly. John Kenneth Galbraith was a professor at Harvard and wrote an infinity of books, I think. One of his books, I was not in political philosophy, I just read the introduction, but he made a very profound remark. He quoted his name to people who know political philosophy. It's a well-known name. John Kenneth Galbraith said, "A society depends far more," these are my words, but this is his idea, "a society depends far more on the willingness of people to cooperate than it does on laws and governmental institutions. What makes a society work? What makes it successful? What makes it productive? What makes the people happy? It's not well-designed laws, well-designed governmental institutions, a fair voting system, good courts, and so forth and so on. It is the ability of people to get along with one another, the willingness to compromise with one another, to cooperate with one another. It's an attitude of solidarity. If you have the attitude of solidarity, even with poorly designed laws and mistaken ideas in the legal system, they'll get around it and handle it in a reasonable way. And if you don't have that willingness to cooperate and integrate, then the most sophisticated legal system is not going to help. The problem in Northern Ireland is not how to design the right kind of government. That's not going to solve the problem. It's not going to solve the problem in Lebanon. It's not going to solve the problem in any place where you have significant civil unrest. There is no governmental system that will integrate 3 million Palestinians into a state of 6 million Israelis. It's just not going to work. The problem is not government. The problem is fundamental attitudes. Whereas, on the other hand, there's some city, I think, in North Dakota that, last time I checked, has a law that on Sundays you're not allowed to use umbrellas. I don't know why. Sometimes, 150 years ago, there's nothing wrong with umbrellas. What happens today?
Is it enforced this law?
Of course not. That's the point. Nobody enforces it because it's stupid. And then you get around to changing it. But everybody knows it's stupid. Nothing up. Speed limits. Every locale has its own custom. You know, New York is 5 to 10 miles over the limit. California, it's infinity. Go as fast as you want. Every locale, and everybody knows, and the cops know also. It's just sort of understood. 65 means 70 to 75. That's what it means. Right? Just read the numbers differently. So, it's really the willingness. The Soviet Union was an integration of a bunch of different countries under one system with one ideology and one philosophy. And the minute they had the chance to break loose, they all broke loose. Why? Because it was a sham. It was a sham. They were held there by the army, that's all. The minute they had a chance to break loose, they broke loose. The United States has integrated an enormous number of different groups and integrated them. The original states have some quite differing philosophies, like some were religiously uniform, closed, some disallowed Catholics. And so, and somehow, they're integrated to the point where only Jeb Bush would think about it. Nobody else would take it seriously. So, it's this question of this attitude. Now, why do I mention this? Because many young people, especially on the left, feel it's very important to demonstrate and to try to push a political agenda. And I think that they are very naive about the effectiveness of a political agenda to really change the conditions of people's lives. I saw an article in Time magazine about 4 years ago. Affirmative action, 30 years later, 40 years later, however many years it was. What area of the United States is the most highly segregated? The Northeast, where all the liberals live and all the radicals live. The most highly segregated socially. So they created legislation that imposed it on the rest of the country, but they made sure that at home, they have their white neighborhoods. Not by law. No, other ways. They managed it. So it's a question more of attitude than it is of laws. Now, you can make the case that what the Torah does is operate on people's attitudes. It's teaching fundamental values. It's teaching priorities. And therefore, it should not be ignored in the attempt to transform society, whereas other people are leading demonstrations to try to institute laws. That's one idea. The other idea is this. I saw a review of John Rawls' political work. John Rawls is maybe the most famous political scientist in America in the 20th century at Harvard. And Thomas Nagel wrote a review of his work. And he made a very interesting observation. Rawls is a classical liberal and trying to formulate classical liberal theory. And here's what he said. In order to have a society that can be organized politically and held together, the values necessary to hold society together have to be more important than the values that divide people. The values that hold society together have to be more important than the values that divide people. So, take religion. This is one of his examples. A person who's religious has religious values, religious beliefs, certain religious goals, imperatives. He also believes that people should be treated fairly, people in general, same religion, different religion, respected, cooperation, integration of society. Which comes first? Which comes first? Which is more important? The liberal theory is, and this, I think, liberalism, the theory anyway, is pretty realistic. If you're going to have a functioning society, the values that divide have to be secondary. The primary values have to be the values of how to make the society function, given that people are going to be different from one another. What happens if you have people for whom that's not true? They don't set up their hierarchy that way. Then this vision of how society is going to work collapses. It collapses. Now, here we have a gigantic publicity force, only they wear a different hat and they go by a different name. It's called Islam. In Islam, it is quite clear that political virtues are second, and Islam is first. And that's why there are so many Islamic states, more Islamic law, less Islamic law. But no one is going to say, I'm going to make Islam second so as to make sure that the... No one. Turkey did it for a while. Now they're gone. They turned back after a few decades. But the rest of them certainly don't do that. Islam is first. And political virtues are second. We certainly take that position. We are not prepared to sacrifice Torah for the sake of having general good relations with people who differ with us on their religious views so that we can all function together in a society. We're not going to do that. But here's a very profound idea, that for a society to hold together and function in a cooperative and integrative way, you've got to make dividing values secondary. And if you're not prepared to do that, then what you're saying is, I don't care if society goes to pieces. This is more important than society going to pieces. And I think that's definitely our view. And we're not going to give up Shabbos in order for society to hold together. We'd rather let society go to pot. Shabbos is more important than holding society together. So that means that we would put a big question mark on the whole foundation of how to hold multicultural societies together. It's hard for us to play that ball game to the hilt when they will decide to try to force certain equality rules on our educational institutions. They will find out that we're not going to play ball, like sexual equality and that sort of thing. So at that point, we'll get off the ship. We won't play ball. Okay. Thank you.